From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Grassroots movements have been popping up around the globe of late, from the Tea Party to the Arab Spring to now Occupy Wall Street. And though the goals and ideologies of these groups differ widely, what the scholar Jeffrey Nielsen says energizes them is the fact that they are peer-based. That is, there's no one person in charge dictating an agenda, no secretive elite manipulating the message. Several years ago, the Westminster College professor and business consultant wrote a book about leaderless organizations, and he argues that what we're seeing now is an evolution toward more cooperative and inclusive group dynamics. Today on the program, Nielsen joins me to talk about redefining leadership, plus research into why some people live so long, the genetics of aging. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. From business to government to the PTA, leaders define expectations, set priorities, and point a way forward. They get credit for increased sales or blame for a public gaffe, but few argue that having leaders is a bad idea. But Professor Jeffrey Nielsen says leadership is a myth. He says modern society is moving toward a leaderless paradigm, and he points to movements like the Tea Party and Occupy as success stories. And today on the program, he's joining me to talk about leadership. Jeffrey Nielsen, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's my pleasure.
Jeffrey S. Nielsen is an adjunct professor of philosophy at Westminster College and Utah Valley University, focusing on ethics, moral decision-making, and democracy. He's the founder of the nonprofit Democracy House Project, a peer-based model to teach political literacy in communities, and he's been a business consultant for Franklin Covey and Wright Management Consultants, and his book is titled The Myth of Leadership, Creating Leaderless Organizations. It's now out in paperback. If you have questions or comments about the leaderless movement, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Later on in the program, we'll be talking about DNA research into why we age. And we'll have two researchers joining me on that discussion. But first, the dynamics of a leaderless organization. Are you part of the Tea Party or Occupy Salt Lake City? And from your vantage point, can leaderless groups be sustainable and productive? Again, our number, 801-355-TALK. Professor Nielsen, you are a professor of philosophy. Organizational structure is typically a field that interests business school types. What got you interested in this?
Well, when I was in graduate school, I was studying the nature of complex adaptive systems and chaos theory and trying to understand if I could find some analogies for the way human systems evolve and develop based on natural systems. And so I had a natural sort of interest in trying to understand the way communities are designed and organized and get managed. And when I came back out here to Utah to teach, I did some business consulting as well. And I came across what I like to call the myth of leadership. And perhaps I should define that just to sort of set the context for our discussion.
Yes, please.
But as I was doing leadership consulting all around the world, I came to express this idea. And the myth of leadership captures the idea that we tend to give deference and status to those who control resources in our organizations. And this has been hardwired into us over millions of years of evolution. And so we give them the title of leader or give them the position of leadership. And this essentially then allows the myth of leadership to legitimize the unequal relationships of power where we freely surrender our moral autonomy and come to cooperate with what becomes the unethical exercise of power in an unequal power relationship. And so I came to realize that in our communities and organizations, we were fundamentally undermining the ability for all of us to flourish in an equal way because of our paradigm of leadership.
So maybe expand on that concept a little bit. What exactly is wrong with leadership? You say it's unethical.
Right. Well, I personally believe that we each as human beings possess equal dignity and value. We possess equal worth. And that requires in our communities and organizations what I call the peer principle, that each one of us possess the equal privilege to speak and we share the equal and reciprocal obligation to listen. That for me is the basic principle of genuine community organizational life. And my problem with leadership is it fundamentally violates that principle. whenever you have a leader, you must also have a follower. You can't have a follower without a leader or a leader without a follower. And the relationship of leader and follower is inevitably, necessarily, by definition, one of unequal power. And the dynamics of unequal power relationships are that the person with the position of high power will come to feel entitled to monopolize information, control decision-making, and command compliance and resources. And the person with the low position of power, the follower, will come to feel obliged to do what they're told, to obey. And this dynamic sets up a relationship which inevitably becomes unethical. You have the coercive or manipulative exercise of power. It's not something you can avoid, just given the basic human nature and the dynamics of community. Leadership sets up relationships of unequal power, and relationships of unequal power are essentially unethical.
So why do we cede our power to somebody else and anoint them a leader? Why do we do this? Why do leaders emerge?
Yeah, well, for 10,000 years, that's the way we've essentially organized our communities. I mean, if you think about all of the ways we've innovated and been entrepreneurs over the past 10,000 years, but the one area where we've remained largely silent is this idea of how to design, organize, and manage our communities and organizations. And essentially, if you go back some 13 to 10,000 years ago, you can see the transition from our hunter-gatherer lifestyle to a domesticated, settled lifestyle. And it was in that domesticated, settled lifestyle that relations of unequal power first emerged. And it was essentially goes back to that period where status was linked to the control of resources, and resources in a village life could be accumulated and acquired. And so you had the emergence of unequal power relationships some 10,000 years ago. And with that emerged this myth of leadership that we've been dealing with ever since. Now, prior to that time, we quite naturally lived in sort of leaderless communities or groups by evolutionary accident. But today, I think that we can, by design, begin to recreate those leaderless communities so each person can have the equal opportunity to flourish and satisfy their basic existential needs for respect and security.
You note in your book that science reinforces this idea of a hierarchy, and in particular, Isaac Newton's ideas. Maybe you can expand on that.
Yeah, well, the idea is that when we were thinking of ways of management theory, organizational theory, essentially was getting its cue from science, and the dominant science of the time sort of would have supported this idea of hierarchy or the myth of leadership. But science itself doesn't necessarily support hierarchy. I mean, if you look at community as a complex adaptive system, and I mean, that's a pretty fancy word, but essentially means that all communities are self-organizing systems, that no single person or part is in control, but the self-organizing dynamic of the whole determines what happens. And a complex adaptive system is one of many parts where those parts interact at the local level, and those local interactions are governed by three simple rules. And depending upon the nature of the parts, this is perhaps getting too complex, but the nature of the parts and the environment or the context of the interactions, you will have the emergence of either unequal or equal power relationships. So I think science shows us that we evolved to be either cooperative, peer-based animals, or we evolved to be competitive, hierarchical animals. It depends upon the context we create for ourselves.
We're speaking with Jeffrey Nielsen, a philosopher and author of the book, The Myth of Leadership, Creating Leaderless Organizations. Feel free to join us. 801-355-TALK is our number. I think everybody's worked in an environment where they've got a very strong boss and they are the underlings.
Right.
And we follow orders. You know, anybody who's been in the military or any kind of institution has experienced that sense of powerlessness that you talk about in your book.
Right.
Why do we stay?
Well, I don't think...
Why do we put up with it?
Well, I think it's... I don't think we think there's an alternative. There's any options, right? I mean, we essentially grow up in organizations and communities that are all leader-based, all rank-based, and we don't really think of any alternatives to that. That's why I'm so excited to see the Occupy Wall Street movements and various elements of the Arab Spring and even the Tea Party, because they give expression to a fabulous stirring of the human spirit. I think we're at the tipping point of a paradigm shift in human history where we will begin to explore all of the possibilities and ways of living together in leaderless communities. And again, leaderless communities don't mean that the communities aren't managed. They have to be managed and organized, but they're organized in ways that every person can participate. They're organized and managed in ways that are open and transparent, where authority and obligation are based on mutual accountability, not on your position in the rank-based hierarchy.
I want to get to some of the specifics of what you're seeing in today's world in a moment, but I guess I want to have a very firm foundation on what we're talking about. So the leaderless movement, what does that organization look like? You say that there has to be some kind of a management. Things still have to get done, but how what are the mechanics? How does it work?
Well, first off, leaderless communities, there's no single template you can impose upon a community. It's the language of it's a vernacular language, so every local community has to find its own way. But in general, we can talk about the idea that any group of people or any community, to be effective or successful, has to accomplish certain tasks, right? I mean, there's the strategic task. You have to have some vision of what it is you want to accomplish. There's the operational task. You have to plan how you're going to accomplish that vision. There's the tactical task. You have to carry it out. There's the resource task. You have to finance it. And then there's the people task. You have to make it meaningful for everyone. And I think you see in these five tasks, you see the way the Occupy Wall Street movement has evolved. They've essentially developed councils and work teams to carry out these tasks in a leaderless way, in a very effective way as well, I would say.
We're speaking with Jeffrey Nielsen. He's a professor of philosophy at Westminster College and Utah Valley University. We're talking about the myth of leadership. That's also the title of his book, now out in paperback. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Or again, you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Bruce is joining us from Salt Lake City. Bruce, hi.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I haven't read your book. I plan to try and find a copy because it's an interesting topic.
Good.
The question is, are there organizations that do well or thrive best with a central leader?
That's a very good question. And usually when I'm talking about this topic, people will also will often point out the military as an example of an organization that needs a strong hierarchical leader. And I might defer to that, but I would argue that what I'm trying to challenge here is the dynamic of leadership or the dynamic of unequal power relationships that leadership sets up. I don't want to criticize any particular institution or any particular leader, because we all know examples of good leaders, of good institutions. But inevitably, the dynamic of leadership is one of unequal power, and it sets up problems where the vast majority of individuals in that organization or community are deprived of actually fulfilling or flourishing as human beings in their fullest possible way. So is there any organization that functions best with a centralized leader? I would have to say no. I think that every organization could transition to becoming a peer-based or leaderless organization. I don't think these transitions should be catastrophic and quick, and I think they have to be gradual. There has to be a gradual process of transitioning from leader-based to leaderless in order not to create the type of, or undermine the success by too quickly changing things. And there are certain competencies as well that are required, but I guess, sorry for that elaborate answer, but the short answer is yes, I don't think any organization actually, or any centralized leadership is actually best for any organization.
Bruce, do you think that a strong figurehead, as somebody at the top who is responsible for the decisions and can take the fall if there's failure, do you think that's a good idea? Or are you buying into this idea that a group, consensus-based mentality works best?
Well, I guess I have kind of a foot in both camps. So I'm marginally a Quaker, and there everything is done by consensus, and that can be good, and it can sometimes really make progress difficult.
Right.
And then I do things like river rafting, where, you know, there really is one person steering the boat. And other people can have jobs and contribute, but there's one person making the decision about where to go, and you really don't have time. I don't think any other scheme would work.
Yeah, well, sorry, Bruce.
So I'm curious, how do you think Apple Computer would do applying your principles?
Uh-huh.
That seems like, Steve Jobs was an iconic leader. His vision really carried the company forward, and I'm not saying I'm a pro or con about everything Steve Jobs did, but it seems like that's a case where one person's vision largely created a huge industry and very successful products.
Yeah.
Bruce, thanks very much for the call. Jeffrey Nielsen?
Well, it's difficult to actually know what the actual history of Apple was. I mean, certainly Steve Jobs was this larger-than-life charismatic figure, and certainly he had fantastic vision. But we're not really able to see behind the scenes in the way Apple actually functioned. We're not able to see whether or not employees of Apple felt like they were respected, the employees of Apple felt like they could flourish as human beings in their jobs, that they could have their needs for respect and security satisfied. In fact, there are stories that perhaps that Steve Jobs was in some cases a rather bad manager or leader. But again, I don't want to criticize any particular company or particular leader, but let me go back and kind of explain something that might help Bruce understand this better. I mean, in terms of a leader-based community, those five tasks that I mentioned tend to be carried out with what I call rank-based management vehicles. There's a fixed leader, there's permanent job assignments, so there's leader follower, and they're arranged hierarchically, that relationship. A peer-based company or leaderless organization or community is also going to be managed through peer-based management vehicles. You have peer councils where the strategic and tactical and operational decisions are made, but then you also have rotational stewardship positions. I mean, Bruce was talking about the person who steers the boat when they're rafting.
But it's not always the same person.
It's not always the same person. I think, obviously, day-to-day decisions can't be always made by a large council. They sometimes have to be delegated to particular individuals in rotational stewardship positions. But those positions are accountable to the councils. They're not leadership positions, so there's a sense of mutual accountability that's required there, along with openness and transparency. And there's also mentors in a peer-based or leaderless community. So there are vehicles to carry out the management functions to address the concerns that Bruce had, because he's quite right. If you had to make every single decision in a council, that in a consensus way, that could become rather problematic. But you don't. There are ways to make decisions that are quite efficient and effective.
We're talking about leaderless movements such as the Tea Party, the Occupy movement, even in business. Can groups without a top-down structure develop cohesiveness and a message that resonates? With us this hour, Jeffrey Nielsen, a philosopher and author of the book The Myth of Leadership, Creating Leaderless Organizations. If you've got questions or comments about leaderless movements, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Today on the program, philosophy professor Jeffrey Nielsen is with me talking about how leaderless movements are the next wave in our evolution and how groups of all kinds, from government to business to the PTA, can benefit from peer-based management. So, is leadership outdated, or do you think a top-down management style still works best? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. I want to go back to the phones, and Charles been waiting from Salt Lake City. Charles, hi.
Yes, good morning, the two of you.
Good morning.
Now, have you, young man, have you been down to the General Assemblies at the Occupy Salt Lake City like I have?
I have not.
You know, it's amazing because I went there, and I've been there since the beginning, and I've been to most of the General Assemblies, and what you're talking about is an illusion. In this, their society down there, there are leaders. There are people that want to lead, and then there's people, depending on their personality, I find, that want to be followers. Because the leaders have always been the main facilitators down there. And there's several groups of leaders, and then they have their followers. And their followers put a motion for a person to become a facilitator. The leader doesn't put a motion for that particular follower to become a leader. And I say that people have their place, that there's some people that want to be the leader, and there's the other people that don't want the responsibility, and they're the followers. They're given assignments, and the leader delegates out to them, and they're happy. If you were to give them the position of the facilitator, they wouldn't know how to do it. They wouldn't want to do it. And I'm saying that in all societies, there's people that rise to the top that are natural leaders, and there's people that are the natural followers. And you can't put the natural followers in a leadership position. They always bow low. They don't want it. They run away from it.
They're Charles, a good point. Thanks very much for the call.
Okay, goodbye.
Jeffrey Nielsen, your response.
Well, I appreciate what Charles said. I think that in a leaderless community or organization, every person is allowed to choose for themselves how they want to participate, how they want to contribute. Not everyone is going to want to be a facilitator. Not everyone is going to want to be take a stewardship position in that community, in that organization. So he's quite right that individuals have their own personalities, their own goals, their own ambitions. And the idea of a leaderless community is not that everyone has to take charge. The idea is that there are equal power relationships, that everyone has an equal privilege to speak and shares an equal and reciprocal obligation to listen, and that there's a commitment to those equal power relationships where everyone can contribute, everyone can choose the level of their contribution, and everyone has a chance to flourish, to have their needs for respect and security satisfied. So it's not that everybody has to be a facilitator. And again, I would challenge Charles' thought of natural leader and follower. I don't think those make any sense. I think there are people who have vision, and we have to allow them to play that role of sharing vision with the community.
But isn't that part of the definition of what a leader is? Somebody who has drive and who has a sense of the big picture.
Well, I don't think so. See, I would challenge that, because as soon as we call someone a leader, we've set up a relationship of unequal power. Whenever you have a formal leader, you have to have a formal follower. And that relationship is one of unequal power. And unequal power always devolves into coercive or manipulative exercise of influence. So I think we can talk about people with vision. We can talk about people who are good at planning, people who are good at carrying things out, and give them that rotational stewardship position, or allow them to be mentors to others to develop that capacity. But as soon as we start using the word leader, we've set up a formal relationship of unequal power, and it's that relationship that's problematic. It's that relationship that for 10,000 years has made human history essentially a story of where the very many have been sacrificed on the altar of the greed and ambition of the very few.
Charles, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. If you'd like to join our conversation, we're speaking with philosopher and author Jeffrey Nielsen. Let's go back to the phones, and Mary is joining us from Salt Lake City. Mary, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for letting me come in on this fascinating discussion. I've been interested in leadership and group dynamics since the beginning of the movement, its development. And it strikes me that your guest has a very idealistic notion of people's behaviors in groups and doesn't seem to have accounted for, or at least I ask the question, how he accounts for the fact that there will be people with behavioral disorders and poor skills in relating to people in a group,
right.
Hidden agendas, mental illnesses, lack of maturity, those kinds of things that are always present.
Okay, Mary, a very interesting point. This does sound awfully utopian. We're all equal, and we're all working toward a common goal. We're all engaged in the same way.
Well, I don't think we're all working towards a common goal. I think that as human beings, we share the same basic needs for respect and security. I mean, Buddha once said that we all want the same thing. We just seek it in different ways. I think we all need respect and security. I think it's also the case that by our very nature, we're status-seeking reciprocal altruists. Again, another fancy phrase, but essentially we're status-seeking, meaning that we seek the recognition and respect of others. And reciprocal altruism essentially means that we tend to care and cooperate with those that we have good reason to think will help us gain status. So we can't change that about ourselves. We are status-seeking, reciprocal altruists who need respect and security. We can't change that. But what we can change is the environment or the context in which we seek status and cooperate. And in rank-based, leader-based organizations, status is tied to your position in the rank-based hierarchy. Whereas in a leaderless organization, status is tied to one's genuine contribution to the well-being of the group. And that's the basic difference. It's not like we can change human nature, but we can change the context, the environment in which human nature functions. Now, but Mary made an excellent point about the different levels of competencies and health of members of communities. And certainly that has to be taken into account. But once again, I think in a leaderless community where the decisions are made in the context of equal privilege to speak and equal and reciprocal obligation to listen, that not only will you have a better respect and treatment of those who are suffering from various disabilities, but even those who lack the present capacity to make genuine contributions will in fact be educated. They will be, those competencies will be developed. That's one of the great things about a leaderless community, is that everyone has the opportunity to develop the competencies to contribute. Right now in a leader-based community, it's essentially only those in leadership positions who have all those opportunities for development. And I've known, in my leadership consulting practice, I've consulted with hundreds of organizations where members or followers or people in low status positions had great ideas, great intent, but they were never able to exercise that because of their position in the rank-based hierarchy.
Okay, well, we've been talking in idealistic terms. I think the jury's still out on the Tea Party and the Arab Spring and Occupy. These are very young movements that we're looking right. at of leaderless examples. So maybe give us a concrete example. One that you give in the book is the W.L. Gore Corporation.
Right.
Tell us how the leadership or the leaderless paradigm works in that context.
Right. Well, I will do that, but let me just kind of go back and quickly say, because I'm often called overly idealistic with this leaderless paradigm, but I argue in the book that it's not idealism. This is inevitable. I think that we are moving as a species towards a leaderless paradigm of management. It's, you look at the younger generation, you look at the technology that we have, the way we're connected on Facebook and all these other information technologies, you see the attitudes and the personalities of the younger generation. And I think the time is ripe for this leaderless movement to take place. But we have to also recognize that we've been in 10,000 years of a leader-based paradigm. I mean, 10,000 years is a long time to be scripted to think in a particular way. And there are very few people that think there's any other alternative to managing communities except through leaders. So this is not going to be it's going to take time to make this paradigm shift, but I think it's one that will happen. Now back to your question about Gore. Mm. It's an interesting story actually, because Gore and his wife both went to Westminster College, where I teach. And Gore was an engineer. He went back to work for a company. And he quickly realized that his input was not being listened to because he wasn't in a leadership position. And so he decided to create his own company that would not have any formal leaders or managers. So Gore & Associates is a quite successful company for 30 plus years, and they essentially run without managers or leaders. You are an associate at Gore, and as an associate, you get to converse and talk to other associates, and you have to use persuasive influence or persuasive power to start new product lines or to get things done. And it's a completely, well, perhaps I shouldn't say completely, but it's quite a peer-based operation, or leaderless operation. They've been quite successful with the philosophy of no managers.
How big is the company?
I don't have the precise numbers of how big it is. I know it's growing. They have facilities in Arizona. Gosh, I would have to look that up.
I guess my question is, does the leaderless model work best with small groups or with big organizations like the movements that we're seeing across the country?
Right.
Does scale affect leadership?
Well, I think it will affect how you implement a leaderless model. Obviously, the larger the company, the more challenging it might be. But this isn't so much a question of how to be most effective. It's a question of ethics. It's a question of what we human beings what our obligations are to one another. And I think the leader-based paradigm violates the basic obligation we have to one another to allow each of us equal opportunity to flourish as human beings, to satisfy those needs for respect and security. I think there's an ethical imperative that says we have to move to leader-based or leaderless communities. And then it's a matter of innovation and entrepreneurialism to find out the best way to do this. I offer one paradigm of how to organize without leaders, but I don't think that's the only way to do it. What I'm essentially asking for is that people begin to explore, they begin to innovate, they begin to become entrepreneurs in this idea of leaderless movements and how to create leaderless communities and organizations.
We're speaking with Jeffrey S. Nielsen, adjunct professor of philosophy at Westminster College and Utah Valley University. His book is titled The Myth of Leadership, Creating Leaderless Organizations. So in the few minutes that we have remaining, how do you do this? How does a group transition from a rank-based model to a peer-based model and get the input
right.
and the buy-in of everyone, including those who are typically thought of as leaders in the community?
Right. Well, in the book, I talk about sort of four guidelines for doing this. I mean, the first guideline is that you have to create a peer-based culture. So you have to essentially articulate the difference between unequal power relationships and equal power relationships. You have to begin to create the culture in the community or the organization where each person has an equal opportunity or equal privilege to speak and the equal obligation to listen. You have to set up a culture where those with power don't feel entitled to monopolize information control, decision-making, and command compliance. So you have to begin to create the culture. Then you have to start to structure the organization in ways that promotes that sort of peer-based thinking. And that means you have to begin to set up councils in these five areas of strategy and operations and tactics and resources and people. And then you have to begin to teach the competencies of communication and decision-making that consensus communication requires.
I want to squeeze in one more phone call. This is Sean from Salt Lake City. Sean, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. Go right ahead.
So I just had a question. I was wondering if you'd ever organized a group. I think it was an interesting conversation, but it seems a little bit like fantasy world and when we're talking about leadership. It seems for any particular topic, there are different people who have energy and vision and motivation. And a lot of times when I'm organized groups, I find people say, tell me what to do. I don't want to think. I just want to do a particular task. And I feel like that doesn't lend itself particularly well to everyone being a leader.
Sean, we touched on this a little bit earlier in the hour, but Professor Nielsen, maybe you can address it again.
Yeah, well, again, in a leaderless community, the basic idea is that you're committed to equal power relationships. No one feels entitled to monopolize information control, decision-making, or command compliance. No one feels entitled to be coercive or manipulative, and no one feels obliged to cooperate with coercive or manipulative power. That doesn't mean that everybody is going to feel like making the same type of contribution. You have to allow for individual eruptions of creativity, individuality. You have to allow for people to say, well, tell me what to do. But again, you can do that in a context of equal power relationships. And again, my basic problem with leadership is that as soon as you have a formal leadership position, you have a formal followership position, and that relationship is one of unequal power. And it's the dynamics of unequal power relationships that are ethically problematic. And that's what I'm trying to address and discuss here. But there's lots of ways. I think we have to become creative here and find ways of involving people and allowing people to choose their level of cooperation in a leaderless environment.
You say that you see this as an ethical inevitability. We are headed this way.
I think so.
Doesn't it run somewhat contrary to human nature, though? I mean, our selfishness, our mm-hmm. greed, our ambitions. Conflict.
Yeah. Again, like I sort of mentioned earlier, we are status-seeking, reciprocal altruists who need respect and security. We can't change that about ourselves unless we, you know, have a new brain. We're hardwired to be that way. But we can create an environment where that human nature will lead to cooperation and mutual trust. Right now, in leader-based environments, that human nature leads to conflict, competition. It leads to coercive and manipulative exercise of power. But it's the context, it's the environment that we can create that will take our human nature and with that create, I think, communities where each of us can flourish as human beings and satisfying our needs for respect and security. So the problem is not human nature. The problem is the environment, the context in which we allow human nature to function.
Jeffrey Nielsen, an adjunct professor of philosophy at Westminster College and Utah Valley University. He's the author of the book, The Myth of Leadership, Creating Leaderless Organizations, now out in paperback. And Professor Nielsen, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the genetics of aging. But first, a quick break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. So what's the secret to living to 100 or beyond? Utah researchers think DNA may help us understand the aging process and even how to slow it down. Joining me now to discuss their work is Dr. Richard Cawthon. He's a research associate professor in the Department of Human Genetics at the University of Utah, and he's been studying human aging since 1995. And Dr. Cawthon joins me in studio. Welcome, Dr. Cawthon.
Thank you.
Also with us, Dr. Ken R. Smith, professor in the Department of Family and Consumer Studies at the University of Utah and director of the Pedigree and Population Resource Program at Huntsman Cancer Institute, which manages the world's largest integrated database of genealogies, medical, and vital records. And he joins me in studio as well. Thank you, Dr. Smith.
Thank you.
If you have questions or comments about aging, the aging process, and what we're learning about it, give us a call, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Dr. Cawthon, you've devoted much of your life, your research life, to the aging process. Why should we find ways to slow down the aging process? Is this just a search for the elusive fountain of youth?
Well, I think there could be some major benefits to slowing down aging, since every major common disease that kills adults has age as its single largest risk factor. If we could slow down aging, we should be able to postpone or even eliminate multiple common diseases that kill adults.
And and we're talking like Alzheimer's and
cancer, heart disease, stroke, infectious disease, Alzheimer's, type 2 diabetes. They're all the major killers in adults have age as their single largest risk factor. So if you could slow down aging, you might be able to simultaneously postpone or even eliminate these diseases, and then you'd have a tremendous drop in the healthcare costs to society, and you'd have all the productivity that would be maintained in these elderly people, and you'd also have the benefit of all their experience and wisdom.
Hmm. You both have decided to focus on the genes of very old people and their ability to remain healthy. Maybe, Dr. Smith, can you describe this demographic? What do centenarians have in common?
Well, centenarians are such an interesting group, and they are a very rare group. Of course, they are less than 0.1% of the U.S. population.
How many are in Utah? Like 150?
There's just a few hundred. We're actually anxiously waiting for the 2010 census final counts to get the final number. But centenarians are maybe not. They surprise you, and by that I mean, they actually possess and engage in a lot of behaviors that probably the rest of us should not follow, and by that I mean they're often it's not uncommon for them to have been drinkers, smokers, may not have done everything that their mother told them to do, and the reason that they're able to live to 100 is that because they possess something else. And in spite of their behaviors, they have lived a very long time. And so I usually tell people, don't ask them what you attribute your long life, because it probably won't help you.
So if we can't ask them, we can take their DNA samples. And Dr. Cawthon, explain kind of the basis of what your research is and how you're proceeding finding this sample of centenarians and what you're discovering.
Well, so we've made a lot of use of the genealogical database in Utah, the Utah Population Database, to identify families where extreme longevity, exceptional longevity is clustering in families consistent with a genetic factor contributing to that trait. And then we've gone out and contacted those folks and invited their participation in a research study, and we get a very high participation rate, and we've collected blood samples, and then we've run what we call a genome-wide genetic linkage analysis to try to find regions of the genome where there's higher than chance co-inheritance of a segment of the genome with the trait of exceptional longevity. So that's what linkage analysis is. So we've narrowed down the regions to look at for the DNA sequence variants contributing to longevity, and we'll be sequencing those regions to identify all the sequence variants there and compare those to what we see in a control population. So in that way, we'll identify the strong candidate sequence variants that might be causative for helping these people live very long. And then we can go look for those in additional very long-lived people.
Do you find that centenarians, that they are clustered in families, or is it kind of just the odd grandmother who lives forever and her siblings have not survived as long? Dr. Smith?
Well, one of the things that we can do with our resources here at the Utah Population Database, these genealogies linked to medical records and vital records, is that we're able to look at centenarians and nonagenarians, those who live over 90. We are able to identify clustering in families that in ways that other places can't. So it's not necessarily siblings, but we can find maybe first cousins, second cousins, more complicated family linkages that way. And the basis for our project is exactly that, to take advantage of that feature, that clustering in families that are identifiable because we're in Utah. And we're exploiting that information to be able to narrow down our search for genetic variants that are associated with longevity.
We're speaking with Dr. Ken Smith, a professor in the Department of Family and Consumer Studies at the University of Utah. Also, Dr. Richard Cawthon, a research associate professor in the Department of Human Genetics at the U. And we're talking about research into human aging. If you have questions or comments, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So do we have enough older people, very old people in their 90s and their 100s to study, Dr. Cawthon?
Well, I would say yes, because we've already had success getting statistically significant linkage signals in our sample set. And so we're hurrying to publish what we found as soon as we can, and really expect that within a year we should have at least one DNA sequence variant identified that has a very high chance of truly contributing to longevity.
Within a year?
Sure. Well, you have to remember we started working on this back in 1996.
So it's been a while. You're ready to have this result.
We're on the cusp. We're about to do it.
We're thankful that we've lived long enough to get to this point.
That's right.
Now, yours is one of several efforts that is looking at the genetics of aging. I understand there's something called the Welderly Study, something else called the XPRIZE competition. How do those two efforts differ from yours?
Well, I think the main difference between those two projects and the one in what we're doing is that the Welderly project and the project involving the XPRIZE, those do not require that the research subjects be related to each other. So for Welderly, they're going to sequence the full human genome on 1,000 people who've made it to age 80 or older with no diagnosis of any chronic disease yet. But those people do not, those people are likely to be related to each other, but it's not necessary for any related affected relatives to be present in that set of subjects in order to have success with that project. They'll get the full sequence, and then they'll compare it to the full sequences of a control population and look for any sequence variants that are statistically significantly increased in frequency in the well elderly compared to controls. And then for the XPRIZE, in that study, as I understand it, they're going to sequence the full genome in 100 people who have made it to 100 years old or older. I think they don't have to necessarily be disease-free, because that's quite an extreme age. And again, they will not need to be related to each other. Those sequences will be compared to a control group to look for anything that is occurring more frequently in the people who've made it to 100 compared to controls.
So why do you think that the family component is so important in this research?
Well, I think the main genetic difference in what we'll find is that the full genome sequencing of for those two projects where you don't require related people, it might turn up a large number of maybe 100 genes where the sequence variants each individually won't have any very strong effect. They may have weak effects, but in combination help the person live to advanced stage free of disease. Whereas the way we're doing our study, it's the nature of our design and our strategy is going to pick up fairly rare sequence variants with strong effect. So it may be less complicated to figure out how the genes that we find in these families are actually having their effects on biochemistry and physiology, as opposed to in the other studies where they may end up with a large number of genetic variants of weak effect. But we can't really know until we see what we get.
Mm. Dr. Smith?
Yeah, I just wanted to just add maybe a slightly different topic on this the effort to identify genes, and I think that your listeners are probably all too aware of these environmental insults that happen to all of us, and we are definitely very serious about trying to identify genetic variants that could be that are associated with exceptional longevity. But you listen to the news, you read the paper, you hear about maybe potential threats to Medicare, threats to income security, and the genes that we will be that we are we think at least the genetic variants that we've I've identified so far and others that will come from the programs that you mentioned a moment ago. Those are all playing out in an environment where some well-known associations with longevity are being threatened. So, if people don't have income security, if their pensions are being threatened, or Medicare and so forth, these things have dramatic. If these trends continue, these can have really quite dramatic effects. Now, individuals that have particular genes and variations of genes may be more protected from these environmental shifts than others. But for the rest of us who aren't so lucky to have the genetic the good genes, these big shifts in income security are going to be. They're just very important. I mean, they're in terms of how the rest of us live, we may not live to 100, but and there'll be special people that live to 100. But I think if you're talking about the population at large, we want to make sure that there's security, stability, certainty. Those are the things that we want to be able to keep our eyes on. And at the same time, we want to be able to make this very serious effort to try to identify these genes associated with aging.
We've only got about a minute left. I wanted to ask what all of this means for us. When in a year you've mapped out the DNA of your control group, of these family clusters, is the goal to try and be able to slow down the aging process, to flip a switch on this gene and allow us to live longer? Dr. Coffin?
Well, I think once we understand how once we find the gene and start to figure out how it works, once the biochemistry of it is understood, then it should be possible to develop medicines that will mimic the effect of the best version of the gene. So The vast majority of people, or most people anyway, will not have the most beneficial version of the gene. But if we understand the biochemistry, it might be possible to come up with medical interventions that allow the all the benefits that the people carrying the best version of the gene are enjoying have those benefits available to everyone. Hmm.
Dr. Richard Cawthon is a geneticist at the University of Utah. Dr. Ken Smith, a medical demographer, also at the U, and they focus on figuring out the DNA of human aging. Gentlemen, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Jesse Ellis and Beth Clifford. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. And you can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org. Tomorrow, bullying and how to prevent it. Tune in for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.